Turn the page. It's the bookmark with Batya Bricker.
Welcome back. I'm Batya Bricker and this is Bookmark. Today we're talking about cool and quirky books. And I've started with Jonas Jonasson. Jonas Jonasson was asked if, well, actually, I asked ChatGPT if Jonas Jonasson himself was as quirky as his books. And this was the answer. Jonas Jonasson is not quite as wild as his books, but he matches their sharp wit, warmth, and humanist optimism. While he doesn't go around solving geopolitical crises or hanging out with elephants like his characters, he's known as thoughtful, quiet, and an observer with a dry, slightly sarcastic sense of humor. And he brings all that to his latest book. It is called The Distinctly Competent District Counselor, a charming and original story of a small declining community struggle to survive in the shadow of the all-consuming metropolis. So now all over the world, people sleep blissfully in the coziest of Trombet beds made in Hamburg. They've successfully cornered the market everywhere except Sweden, which is why the new owner, Conrad Kaltenbacher Jr., is desperate to expand there. Seeing an opportunity to attract 800 new jobs to her small decaying town of Halsterholm, new district councillor Julia Back jumps right into spearheading a persuasive campaign with an unprecedented charm offensive to win the contract over Stockholm. A roundabout is hastily renamed in honor of Angela Merkel and adorned with black, red, and gold flowers. A German school is quickly established under the leadership of three elderly pensioners, and the town's swimming pool is rapidly transformed into a beer house. It had been empty for years anyway. Julia's tenacity impresses the German dream bed boss, Conrad Jr., but has she bitten off more than she can chew? If you need something lighthearted and breezy, this book is the ideal giggle-inducing palate cleanser between more serious reads. It's downright bonkers and it's fabulous fun. Jonas himself knows how zany the books are, and he doesn't take himself that seriously. He says, "To me, it's strange that quality literature is supposed to not be funny or feel good. I don't see the conflict. If we didn't deal with mankind with a glint in the eye, I don't think we could survive." What are you currently reading? I would love to know. Let me know on the WhatsApp line, 061-895-1019. But for now, I want to share with you a book that I picked up simply because of the cover. The cover was so evocative, and it certainly didn't disappoint. It's called The Infamous Gilberts, and it's by Angela Tomaski. And it's kind of the remains of the day meet the Royal Tannenbaums in this darkly funny debut novel about a wealthy, eccentric family in decline and the secrets held within the walls of their crumbling country manor. Thornwalk is the long-term home of the Gilbert family, and it's being handed over to a chain of luxury historic hotels. Millions are going to be spent in the restoration. But for every so-called improvement, what is going to be lost? And before the hotel people arrive, with their clipboards and their skips and their bottles of bleach, we meet Maximus. Maximus is the loyal guardian of the Gilbert's legacy, and he invites us on a final tour of the one stately home where each room holds a secret, from the bolt on the blue room to the tiny dents in the bar at the nursery window. These are the keys that unlock the weird and wonderful lives of the five fatherless Gilbert children. The way I would describe this book: eccentric, mad, moody, immersive, entertaining, sad, and hugely original. I see that my interviewee is online, and I'm very delighted to see him there with his wall of books, guitar in the background, and of course his pooch. But before I welcome him, I just want to talk about a nonfiction book, because I know that you love nonfiction. And this is a book that I discovered at Exclusive Books Hyde Park. It's not available everywhere else. You can get it online, though. And it's called This Way Up: When Maps Go Wrong and Why It Matters. It's written by the Map Men, and I adore people who are passionate. It doesn't really matter about what. If they're passionate and they can express that passion, I love that. And Mark Cooper Jones and Jay Foreman are two hell of a passionate fellows. If you enjoy quirky, humorous nonfiction, this book is for you. What they've done is they've looked at the very best wrong maps. Some of them are decades old, some of them centuries old, some of them so recent that they are still being published today. They include world maps, colonial maps, corporate maps, Soviet maps, pioneer maps, news maps, and maps whose intended use was hijacked for a French surrealist political movement in the 1950s. I kid you not. Whether you're an avid map junkie or simply map curious, this is a unique tale of adventure, error, and unexpected humor. And it really does ask the question, what on earth happened here? The first chapter is all about New Zealand. What happened to New Zealand? Because more often than not, New Zealand was left off the map. In fact, so much so. And through years and years of being left off the map, it's become a kind of insider joke between New Zealanders. And that's how the book starts. The other fascinating thing I found was how, as Westerners, we know the map of the world. There's kind of, if you look at it, there's the Americas on the left, there's Africa and Asia in the middle, and Australia on the right. But if you were raised in Japan, you would have had that map on the wall, and you also would have had a map that cuts not through the Atlantic, but not through the Pacific, which is what our map does, but through the Atlantic, which puts Japan in the center of their map. And when you look at the map, you barely recognize anything. It is completely different, the vantage point of our world. This book is, it was a Sunday Times bestseller. It's a Waterston's best nature and travel writing feature book, and I highly recommend it. After the break, we'll be chatting to the coolest kid in the South African fiction world at the moment. Sven Axelrad burst onto the literary scene in 2023 with his magical debut, Buried Treasure, which I'm afraid is still my favorite, even though I've now read the fourth, which is The Dogs of Vivo, which has just hit the stores. Sven is an accountant who reads a lot. He's covered in tattoos. He plays the guitar. He loves his dog. And it's going to be so much fun, so stay with me. But for now, a word from the sponsors.
Turn the page. It's The Bookmark with Batya Bricker.
Welcome back. This is Chai FM's book show, Bookmark, the home for stories and the people who love them. And I'm your host, Batya Bricker. Today is all about the cool kids of the literary world. The quirky, the sexy, the stylish, the books with swagger, with attitude. And I am delighted that we are joined by author Sven Axelrad, the new darling and possibly the coolest kid of South African fiction at the moment. Sven burst onto the literary scene in 2023 with Buried Treasure, and it was followed by Various, and now The Dogs of Vivo has just hit the stores. Sven, a very warm welcome.
Thank you much. It's really lovely to talk to you guys.
Before we begin, let's talk about the character of Sven Axelrad. Who is he, and how did this straight-laced, well, sort of, I don't know if you were ever straight-laced, but your profile is accountant, but lover of dogs, music, and tattoos, become this uber-stylish fiction writer that we meet today?
Thank you. I talk a lot about what cool really is. You know, it's lovely to someone to tell you that you're cool, but I talk about it a lot in the books as well. But, coolness is up for interpretation. It's kind of being kind is cool. Being a good parent is cool. Listening to people that you meet on the street's cool. So I'll take cool in any format I can get it. But I've always felt like the accountant was a bit of a disguise. It was when I was 19, like the characters in my book, I wanted to be a musician. I thought that maybe I would make it one day, playing small gigs around Durban, in the sweltering heat. And I think that's maybe why I got the tattoos and stuff back then. I wanted to sort of have some kind of secret pictures on my skin underneath my collared auditing shirt to sort of remind me that I was doing this job, but it wasn't who I was,
I love that. I love how you describe yourself as an old school desk.
Yes, pretty much. Yeah, that's how I see it. Yeah. And I mean the format of my tattoos is very, very that it looks incoherent, but that's what I like about it. Life is a little bit incoherent at times, and I think the art should follow,
You know, Sven, when I was preparing this interview, I kept on putting quotes from you. You are just so highly quotable, and I'm going to just push one in now because I think it encapsulates who you are. You say that maybe it's the tattoos, my posture, or the faint smell of coffee and unrequited hope on my skin. Whatever the reason, I love that people are surprised by what I do. In fact, I often wonder how I ended up spending my days working with numbers when for most of my life, I've been convinced that if answers do exist, they exist in prose. So beautiful. And I think it's this combination of style, but combined with philosophy and poetry, that makes you pack out rooms at festivals like Franschhoek, which is really what you did. You spoke a bit about the power of your writing process, and I'd love to hear more. But can you touch on the power of secrets? Because somehow some of your tattoos, I think that's it's kind of a theme in the Sven world. Talk to me about the power of secrets in your writing process.
Before I do that, I love that what you said about style, because there's an old, I think it's a Bukowski quote where he says that, I'm going to get it wrong, but he says something along the lines of, I would rather do a boring thing with style than something really outrageous with no style. And I think that's art to me. Like, I really try and pick out what art is, and art is something done with an intention and style. And that what's really cool about that definition is it opens it up to everything. You can wash the dishes with style, with a bit of music on. You can do anything with style, and it becomes an art, But the power of secrets, I love that you brought that up. It's mostly got to do with music with me. My writing process is the first thing I ever do before I write a single word on the page is that I obsess about making a playlist that I'm going to listen to while I write the book. And I obsess about it for a long time. It probably is the biggest part of my, I think other writers plan their novels. All I do is plan a playlist. That's about as far as my planning goes.
How marvelous.
And I'm going to listen to that playlist every day for probably close to a year while I write. And the idea of it is that I know it so well and I'm so entrenched in it that I don't hear it anymore. I kind of feel like I'm training myself like a rat going after a piece of cheese. So when I actually sit down to write, I put the playlist in and I'm immediately in the world that I need to be in. I feel young again, or I feel whatever my characters are feeling. And I don't have a lot of time, obviously, with my day job, so I have to get there quickly with the writing, and it's a nifty trick because I could write anywhere. I mean, if you stuck me in an airport, as long as I've got a playlist on, I'm in my world already, and everyone wants to know what's on the playlist, and this is where the secrets come in because I feel terrible about it, but I don't like telling people what's on those playlists because I feel like they're powerful. Secrets are powerful in good and bad ways. A bad secret obviously can break a relationship apart and that kind of thing. But a good secret, like keeping some little arty details to yourself. Like, I'll tell you all about my childhood. I'll tell you how I grew up. I'll tell you what all the good and bad things that happened to me. But I probably won't tell you what I ate for lunch. For some reason, I'm going to keep that secret to myself. And I think it's important that humans have these little things that are just ours. And writing a novel is like that for a whole year. You're dying to tell people what you're working on, but you don't. I've made this mistake before where I have, but you don't tell them. And that secret, instead of getting that little bit of validation immediately, this is what we want in the modern world, especially in the modern world with phones, and we want a little bit of validation straight away. But instead, you turn that secret inward, and it becomes like a little nuclear engine that drives you to finish the project that you're working on. Is this making sense?
Sven,
Yeah.
I know this so well because I'm not the writer that you are, of course, but I have written a children's book, and writing the second one, I was warned not to speak about it before it was born. And the minute you share it, it kind of loses some of the magic and you lose some of the momentum. It's really interesting. I think the power of keeping it secret means that, as you say, you channel all your energy into the project. So yeah, I think it's very powerful what you were talking about. And to share with the listeners, the Dogs of Vivo is the product of a best kept secret, maybe for the last year. Did you say that it took to write? And the book is, the blurb goes something like this: that you can't win it all, but everything, and I mean everything, can be lost. And Sven welcomes you to Vivo. There's Art, there's Maggie and Felix, and they spend all their time in the Mean Monsoon. It's a bar, and they're drinking and talking about making it big. And really, this book is about that. It's about making your way in the world and hoping to make it big. Art loves Maggie, but he has a problem with his heart. Maggie loves music, but can't get a break. Felix, who is currently homeless, loves everyone and lands up sleeping on lots of different couches, a different couch every night almost. It's playful, it's nostalgic, it's sexy, it's philosophical. Sven, you open with a warning to the reader. Tell me about the warning and why.
It's a little cheeky, I suppose.
Perhaps should I
That's a
read
warning.
it just
Yeah,
so
please
that
read it. Yeah,
listeners
that would help.
get a sense of this is what the warning is? The author will not answer for any problems his writing may raise. It may be hard on the reader, but he'll have to accept this from here on in.
That is a quote from Nicanor Parra, who's a very interesting, was a very interesting and quite eccentric figure in Latin American poetry. And he, in fact, so much so that he called himself an anti-poet, and his poems are that, against poetry in some ways. And I think that this was a great, I'm not, nothing in this. I loved what you were saying just now before we came on about who was it? I can't remember the author, but you said that he thinks that literature should be fun and not stuffy, and you should be able to. This warning, although it sounds like something might be difficult that's coming up, I completely agree with him. You, literature, I love José Saramago and all these Latin American fiction writers, but I'm also extremely frustrated by them because it's very literary and sometimes very dry or hard to get through certain sections of a novel. And I'm hoping that I've managed to pick up all the joy of their style, but make it extremely accessible. Like if you're not interested in philosophy at all, or the references I'm throwing into the book, let them pass you by. It's a lot of fun anyway. It's just a fun story. But if you do understand the multiple layers, it's a fun story with something else going on underneath it, And now I've completely forgot what you asked me.
I really asked. No, this is wonderful. It's wonderful
Yeah.
to get the warning unpacked. And yes, I think fasten your seatbelt for this one because it's a different kind of read. One of the ways I think you make your work so accessible, just fun, as opposed to, yes, with the philosophy, yes, with the poetry, yes, with the deeper insights, but just fun, is because you have created a place in Vivo. And Vivo is a created world, it's an imagined town. Paige Nick wrote about it, and she said, to step into Vivo is to step into a place you've never been but always wanted to live in. For those who may not have visited Vivo, introduce us.
Well, yeah, Vivo is a town, again, named after a book that really got me starting to start writing. There was a novel I read when I was 20 called Senor Vivo and the Cocoa Lord, which I love so much that I named my little town after it. But the idea was that it was a little bit of all the towns I love or have been to. The It's a bit of Durban, in the way that the municipality doesn't work so well. It's a little bit of Johannesburg, in that it can be a little bit dangerous on certain street corners. It's a little bit of Madrid. It's a bit of Lisbon, very much. Havana, even. So I've mixed in these beautiful places, and I think the reason I see it like a stage set, actually, is very few locations in my novel. This novel takes place largely in a bar, and I almost see it as the curtains open and we have a narrator that says, "Hey, welcome. The play's about to start. Take your seats. Here's a little warning from Nicanor Parra," and then we start, and it opens up on the coffee shop or the bar. And the reason I wrote this way was that I'm someone who's always felt a little bit lost or confused. There's this guy who's wanting to be a musician, but he's an accountant in his day job. And I think a lot of us feel this way, that we've sort of missed our calling, or we're not quite sure what we want or what this life is all about. And when I wrote music, I always felt like I understood the world, but probably only for like 3 minutes at a time. Well, sometimes when you listen to your favorite song, you feel understood, or you feel like you understand your life just for a second. But then the clouds come back over and you lose your perspective. So when I ride into Viva, I kind of feel like I understand the world for a bit longer. I feel like I get to understand it for the length of a novel now. And it's an illusion. I don't understand the world at all. But being able to watch my characters play out their lives on a stage extends a lot of compassion to them from me. And I think because a lot of it is some of my life, I was a young kid wanting to be a musician like these guys. I extend a lot of compassion to myself too, the younger version of myself. And I feel like it makes sense to me for a little bit. And if it doesn't make sense, I feel like at least we're together. I suddenly appreciate all my friends. And sorry, I'm talking a lot, but there was a time when I was about 10 years that I wrote for that I couldn't get anyone to publish me. And I felt like a failure. I felt like a complete failure. I was writing. I never told anyone. I didn't used to tell my friends, because I didn't want to tell them that I got another rejection letter, And I almost quit during this time. But the thing that made me not quit was imagining myself as a character in one of my own stories. And I thought I liked this guy. I like this accountant that writes novels and is not getting anywhere. In fact, I really like this guy. I probably like him more than a successful novelist in a novel, But I don't like him if he quits, or and I don't like him if he complains too much. And so that's how I kept going. I was like, cool, well, I'm just going to be one of my own characters. And I still feel like I belong in Vigo. I still feel like you might see me in the background walking down the street behind the main story. I feel like I live there.
Oh, I think we could bump into you in Vivo, most definitely. I was in the room when you asked the audience who here has had an easy journey to adulthood, and not one hand went up. Tell us about your characters' journeys to adulthood, Art, Maggie, and Felix in The Dogs of Evo.
It's the I think people think of this as something that's like quite hard or sad, but I don't see it this way. This whole novel is built around the idea that the only way to grow up is to experience some form of ruin, personal ruin, which is heartbreak. And that's why I asked that question in the room, because I know there's not a single person that has fallen in love and it's all gone smoothly. It's just not the way love works, and it's not a bad thing. It's all a lot of my art and a lot of who I am is built off those pivotal moments of heartbreak and hope deferred. And I think it's a beautiful idea. But at the same time, when you're young, unfortunately, it's unavoidable. It's coming for you. But I suppose we all live this way, right? We live knowing that we're going to die one day, but we don't take it too seriously. And I think young people probably live knowing that they'll be heartbroken one day soon. But what can you do about it? You just got to carry on going through. So my young characters are at that pivotal stage in their life where they're about to experience something that helps them progress to the next phase of their lives. And I think people see it as sad, but I don't. If I think about myself at that age, I loved. My main character has had a heart transplant, and the rumor is going around the bar that he might have had a dog's heart transplanted into his chest. And that was me when I was a kid. I loved as if I had a dog's heart in my chest. I had a bit of a rough upbringing, and I placed all of my chips on love, and I believed that romantic love would save me, if I just bet everything on it, which is a complete recipe for disaster, right?
It's a recipe for disaster, but I think it's a function of our age as well. We were brought up in Disney, and so it's everyone's fairy tale dream, to have a prince or princess or whatever variant, you want to ride off into the sunset with.
And I think for me, a lot of it was I actually wanted to be a prince for someone else. I know that sounds silly. It was more about like this idea of who I could be, which again is unrealistic. And I lost that bet I placed on love. But I'm married now, and I'm married to the most beautiful and lovely woman. And love, I understand love in a different way now. So I don't, it might not be the same love that I loved with my Disney love when I was 19, but it's real now. I call it kind of hard-boiled romance, where you see what love actually costs and what it and who you really are and who your partner really is, and then you choose to love anyway. And it's such a beautiful full version of love. And I actually really like both versions. But I couldn't have got to this version and understood it without going through heartache. And that's kind of where my characters are. And I feel badly for them. I really want to protect them from it, but I know, I think a lot of, I don't have kids, I've just got my little dog that I treat like a child. And I think a lot of parents feel that need to protect their children from just loneliness and making friends and all the hardship they're going to go through, just, getting their driver's license. But you really can't protect them. You just got to love them, right?
Yeah, I don't have the answers to that. That recipe is, oh my goodness, that's a whole different discussion. And unfortunately, our time is up, Sven. And I feel like I'd like to take this offline and have coffee with you and continue chatting. And so do
Anytime, I'd love to.
I, and so do our listeners. I'm getting feedback from our listeners just appreciating your authenticity and your sincerity, which comes through not just in the way you have spoken today, but in your book as well. Thank you so much for joining us. It's been a blast of the freshest, coolest air. Dogs of Vivo is available online and in all good bookstores, along with the other four books. To get you into the sultry mood of this book, we're going to end this interview by playing out with both Sven and Arts one of their favorite tunes. And I know you don't like to share your playlist, but we're just sharing a snippet. And it's Mazzy Star's Fade Into You. The
Oh,
acoustic
beautiful.
guitar will take you right into the heart of Vivo. It's bar, it's bookshop, it's kitchen, it's grungy, and sass, and just enjoy it. So first a word from our sponsors, and then I will leave you to Mazzy Star.
Turn the page. It's the bookmark with Batya Bricker.
Welcome back. I'm Batya Bricker, and today's show is all about the cool and the quirky. I asked you what you're reading, and I'm loving hearing the responses. I know Theo of Golden is a popular one coming up. It really is the warmest hug of a read. Howard Feldman is reading Sally Smith's A Case of Life and Limb, and he loved it so much that he pressed it into my hands too. So guess what I'm reading this weekend? A book called Cozynomics. Has come up as well, how the South African informal economy works. And it's getting very good reviews. In fact, it's an arresting cover. And I think that that has really contributed to its great success. And it's so much part of the South African social and communal fabric. It's certainly worth taking a look. If you think that Sven Axelrad was stylish, wait until you read more about Cynthia Erivo. Cynthia Erivo is the critically acclaimed English actress, singer, and songwriter. She's an EGOT contending powerhouse, EGOT being the acronym for Emmy, Grammy, Oscar, and Tony Awards. And she's been celebrated for her powerhouse vocals and commanding screen presence. She featured in The Color Purple in Harriet, but it's in Wicked that I think she is unforgettable. In that role of Elphaba, who is the Wicked Witch of the West. And for generations, the Wicked Witch of the West was simply the villain in The Wizard of Oz, green-skinned, cackling, and irredeemably evil. And then along came the novel and musical Wicked, which asked a startling question. What if we have misunderstood her all along? What if the villain was never the villain? What if the story looked entirely different from the other side? Cynthia Erivo learned the music to Wicked a decade before she needed it. And she didn't know that these were actually going to change her lives, these same lyrics. And 10 years later, she had the chance to perform the songs on a world stage. And she changed the role forever. Her book is called Simply More, a book for anyone who has been told they're too much. And this jacket as well is just totally fabulous. There are a mountain of frills around her neck and glorious splashes of color, both on her dress and her face. And it kind of symbolizes a lot of what the book is about. In a series of powerful and personal vignettes, Cynthia Erivo reflects on the way she's grown as an actor and a person, the lessons she's learned over the years of performing, and how we are capable of so much more than we think. Just as she persevered through obstacles on the stage, working step by step, day by day, to align with music, lyrics, and dialogue, so too did Cynthia fall in love with running. And the running motif goes through the whole book. And I thought, I'm not a runner, so it's not something that usually resonates with me. But she speaks about how you run through life in three ways: with your legs, with your head, and with your heart. And that really spoke to me. I think that's true. And different parts of life require different parts of you to run the race. We all have hopes and dreams that we want to bring across the finish line. We all falter, we take missteps, but we keep moving forwards towards that end goal. Cynthia is still running marathons on stage and on screen, in her work and in the city streets. Each challenge has allowed her to lean into the wisdom of her body and to strike that physical and mental balance. Some people are saying when they read it that it's too flowery. She's very woke. She's too woke for me. But I absolutely loved it. There's a quote that says, Cynthia Erivo is beauty and grace, kindness and love. And I think she is. I just want to read you the introduction because it gives you a feel and tone for the rest of the book, called Simply More. And it says, Dear reader, I'm writing this as I prepare for the production of Jesus Christ Superstar to be presented at the Hollywood Bowl, in which I will play the role of Jesus, a choice that's generated some degree of controversy. This dispute just points out to me yet again that sometimes I'm simply more than many people expect or want. Maybe you're the same. And of course, she goes on to take us through some amazing highs, lows, and everything in between in her life. I highly recommend it. I hope you have enjoyed today's show, Books with Swagger and Style. We started off with Jonas Jonasson's The Distinctly Competent District Counselor. We went on to The Infamous Gilberts by Angela Tomaski. We spoke about the nonfiction book on maps called This Way Up, When Maps Go Wrong and Why It Matters by the Map Men. We had a long, beautiful, and authentic chat to Sven Axelrad around his Dogs of Vivo. And we've ended with Cynthia Erivo's Simply More. Smart, stylish, and slightly subversive. Next week's show is all about people who have lived a life of calling rather than career. People who have been guided by purpose, by service, by taking care of either the environment, the animals and birds in it, communities, the people in it, humanity, or even heritage. So join us next week. We're going to be chatting to Rabbi Moshe Silberhaft on the launch of his new book, Journeys Continued. His first one was The Traveling Rabbi, My African Tribe. And this is the second one in that installment. So stay tuned, tune in next week for another episode of Bookmark. But for now, goodbye and happy reading.